Well, my name's Nelia Mann, and I'm going to talk to you about some work that Joe Polchinski and I have been doing. The basic idea is to study integrability in the coset model OSP 2n plus 2, 2n. So there are a lot of different theories that I'm going to be talking about today, so I'm going to draw a diagram for you so you can see them all. Okay, so the starting point is here. This is an O(n) coset model that basically has an action of this form with a constraint that phi I equals 1. The reason it's the starting point is that we know the exact S matrix for this model, and we know that it's factorizable, so you can use integrability. Here, what we're doing is we're taking the limit n goes to 2. This is a conformal limit. This O2 theory is massless. This has a dynamically generated mass. The same is true over here. Conveniently, this O2 theory is basically just a single free field. So this theory is exactly solvable by other very easy means. It's just a free theory. On the other hand, you can start here, and you can add 2n bosons and 2n fermions. And what happens is that within an O(n) sector, the S matrix doesn't change because the bosonic and fermionic loops cancel out. And then you can extend the exact S matrix using the symmetry. So we also know the exact factorizable S matrix over here. We don't believe so. This, of course, as you can see from the title of my talk, is the theory that I'd really like to talk about. This theory is massless because we take the n to 2 limit, but it also has lots of particles, and it has a fair amount in common with ADS5 cross S5 sigma model, which is, of course, what we'd really like to study. We want to apply integrability to ADS5 cross S5, but nobody knows the exact S matrix. So this theory, it has bosons and fermions, and it has sectors. For example, if you look at, you know, an O6 sector in here, this is a sector similar to the S5 in the ADS5 cross S5. And what we'll see is that semi-classically, they should be essentially identical. And we can compare the semi-classical results from this analysis to ADS5 cross S5 results semi-classically on the 5-sphere. So that's basically the goal. We're going to start here, do this as a warm-up, figure out how to take the conformal limit, and then we're going to move over here and do the same thing for more complicated systems. So the S matrix, which is exact and factorizable for O(n), is a sum of 3 terms. That are basically determined by the symmetries of the system. There are 3 tensor structures that are, you know, create O(n) invariant systems. So we have 3 terms. The sigma i's depend on theta which is the rapidity difference and n minus 2. The rapidities are just defined as the momentum of the particle is m sinh theta. The energy of the particle is m cosh theta. So the difference in rapidity between two particles doesn't change when you change reference frame. So that's the quantity that the S matrix is dependent on. It's also dependent on n minus 2.
Can you remind us what sort of particle is scattering?
Well, in ON, it's just bosons and fundamental representation of ON. These guys here. These here.
So some sort of bare particles. Do you have about solitons?
Yeah, I mean, it's not so obvious. What if you write on a Lagrangian, what are the particles that I expect?
So if you look at the poles of the S matrix, you have the records on the same particle.
They're just
some of the bare
exceptions. Yeah, essentially. So here we have basically an S matrix that's formed of three things. We'll start with, we're going to start, because we want to take the ON goes to a 2 limit, we're going to start with just a whole bunch of identical particles that have some definite charge in the O2 that we'll keep as we take the n to 2 limit. And in this case, I'm going to have J identical particles. Charged in O2. Sigma 1 doesn't contribute, and these two contribute equally because they're identical particles. So you can just define the identical particle S matrix as sigma 2 of theta plus sigma 3 of theta. And again, it's a function of the rapidity difference in n minus 2. And we write down the basic beta ansatz for the system because it's integrable. And that takes the form e to the IPL equals the product over J not equal to I of the S matrix.
Sorry, what does sigma 1 contribute?
Basically, this has the tensor structure that these two particles annihilate and create two more.
Time is like a reading time. Is it left to right or up and down?
I believe it's left to right here.
Okay.
Sorry.
Okay, so wait, that makes more sense now. So I see if they're both charged, you're saying?
If they both have the same charge, they can't annihilate. So basically you
will. Okay, so time goes from left to right. Or
I'm sorry. Time. There we go.
Do you know what went into the determination of this S matrix?
So basically, the relative factors of sigma 1, sigma 2, and sigma 3 is fixed by the Yang-Baxter equation. And another amount of information is fixed by unitarity. But that doesn't fix everything. There are these undeterminate poles that you can add. And basically what happens is you take the simplest possible guess and you do some calculations and you compare it to semi-classical perturbative calculations. And if you get the wrong answer, you go back and you add a factor to your S matrix. So this is actually the simplest one, the first one that they tried. But
well,
that's the procedure. Yes, the Zamolodchikov brothers.
Simplest guess being a product of four gammas divided by four gammas.
Yeah, sigma two is some ugly function involving 8 gamma functions, which is why I'm not writing it down, because first of all, it's really long and ugly, and second of all, it's not the same as what would happen in ADS5 cross S5. We would have something else, so I don't want you to focus on that. but it's some function of theta that we understand and we know. Okay?
In your identical?
Yeah, that's the, sorry. That's the identical particle S matrix. And this is, of course, just a generalization of the free particle quantization of momenta when you put it on a compact space of length L. And I should mention that this equation is not literally true until you take the large size limit.
There is something funny about this equation, right? Because on the right you have a relativistic S matrix, and on the left you have this funny.
Well, yes, we substitute P in sinh theta, and we express everything in terms of theta.
No, but I think like somehow on the left you have a compact system, which doesn't quite have the symmetry of 1 plus 1 dimensional relativistic feature. On the right you have a relativistic S matrix.
It's still
so
true, even
on the right you somehow are in an infinite system, on the left you are on a cylinder.
Well, what I'm saying is that this equation isn't true until I take the length to infinity anyways, and then over here I'm not really on a cylinder anymore.
So wait, you're taking the length to infinity, or
Yeah. Something
simultaneously with theta?
Yes. What's going to happen is, in order to get something non-trivial here, I'm going to take the number of particles to be large. And then the difference between adjacent thetas is going to become small.
So S vanishes
at infinity equals
0?
I think S is equal to 1 or negative 1, possibly, at theta equals 0.
So if L goes to infinity, what is P sub I doing? That looks like an undefined P sub I.
So what happens is the... Okay.
I see.
As L goes to infinity,
M sin theta I.
Right.
Okay, good. So I guess you want something like theta goes to 0, theta I is all go to 0, or the M's uniformly go to 0 or something.
No.
M is fixed.
I'm gonna go through the large L limit in a second. So I just wanted to point out that this equation isn't technically true until I take the large L limit. I didn't want to lie to you. So the next thing we want to do is we want to take the large L limit, and you start by taking the logarithm. So there's an undetermined integer from the logarithmic branch. And basically what's going to happen is I'm going to take the difference between this function for a particle. I'm going to go ahead and replace this with im sinh theta I. What's going to happen is I'm going to take the difference between this equation for particle I and for particle I plus 1. And I'm going to send L to infinity and J to infinity such that the number density of particles stays constant, and also the difference between adjacent guys times L is finite, so this becomes a density function. And also, I'm going to make an assumption that every integer that could possibly be used is being used. These integers in I, they have to be different for each one. If you go back to the beta ansatz and you try to plug in a solution where this n is equal to another n for a different particle, then you wind up with a wave function that blows up. So they have to be different, and the closest you can pack them is this way. So this is my structure. And what you get is an integral equation for the density of theta with a source term and an integral where, so k of theta is just dependent on the S matrix. And these, the limits of integration just describe the largest and smallest possible values of the rapidities that you take. And rho of theta is defined to be zero everywhere except on this band. So you wind up with the number density of particles being this integral. Okay.
So where do you look into the special state? What is the special state?
I've made some assumptions, right? So basically what this is going to turn out to be is going to be, it's going to be the lowest energy state for a given amount of momentum.
We can take equal m's, or
if it's for me? If, well, if I, you mean if I set these two equal to each other?
The line above. Can you take ny plus 1 equals ny?
Okay, so if you set, if you, using the prescription that I've used, if you set ny plus 1 equal to ni, then you have two rapidities that are equal. And what I was saying earlier is that if you plug this into the wave function that is the beta ansatz, you get bad behavior. You get an infinity. So you don't want to do that. Okay? So, now we have the beta ansatz equation, the thermodynamic beta ansatz equation for On, but what we want is O2, so we're going to take the conformal limit here. And what we want to know basically is what happens to this equation when I take the conformal limit. So you have this range of rapidities. I want to take n to 0 and n to 2. You have this range of rapidities. And what we find is that basically what happens is this range of rapidities breaks up into three regions. These are going to be left movers. These are going to be right movers. These in here carry charge, but no energy or momentum. So that's a little weird, but.
M is related to the coupling constant in the original signal.
In?
M. You said
M is a dynamically generated mass.
Okay.
And it's proportional to N minus 2?
Not exactly, but I'll show you exactly what stays fixed in the limit in a second. So we call these zero movers. And they don't move. What is important to realize is that where these divisions come depends on how you take the limit. This is located at some point log mu over m minus. So the definition depends essentially on the energy at which you take the mass to zero. The definition of what is a right mover and a left mover and what is a non-mover. But effectively, these guys contribute to the energy and momentum. These guys don't.
Is there some subtlety in taking this? I think probably O2 signal model has.
There are plenty of subtleties.
To the radius.
Sorry, can I say again?
Doesn't auto model has some parameters corresponding to the radius of a circle? ON model is basically sphere, right?
Yeah.
So n equal 2, we need to give a circle.
Right,
so
and for us,
like the radius of the circle.
For us, we've defined the radius to be 1, but...
So you know a winding mode?
Yeah, we're going to get winding modes, and basically I'll recover that information and... Yeah. Yeah. So there's a little bit of subtlety in how we take this, but what happens is this integral equation splits into three parts.
How do you come to this picture?
How did we come to this picture? It's a long story. We started by thinking of O2 as its fermionic dual. And that has a different massive perturbation. And we started with that S matrix and found in doing that we build these right movers and left movers that aren't very well defined, that aren't normal right movers and left movers. And then when we came to here, we realized that we had to add the zero modes. The short answer is that these zero movers exist because the S matrix, the S matrix that I look at for finite difference between theta and between the rapidities of the particles, as I take that rapidity difference to infinity, which is like the S matrix between two left movers, isn't equal to the S matrix between a right mover and left mover, so there has to be something in between.
So in terms of P and theta,
I mean that these particles.
What is the momentum?
The energy and momentum of a particle goes like this. So unless theta scales very large, these give nothing.
Non-mover, what are its values of P, E, and theta?
P and E are zero, then.
So M is zero.
Because we're taking the massless limit. So the equations... So when you take, for example, the right mover equation becomes something like this. This range is basically just shifted. B tilde R is defined as BR minus log mu over M. So this becomes semi-infinite on the negative side because of this, essentially. This becomes mu is the energy scale at which you take the conformal limit. So we've rescaled theta, we've shifted theta, and this means basically I got this from the S matrix where I took the difference between rapidities to be finite as I took n to zero.
So you take n to 2 first and then take n to 0?
I take it at the same time.
Oh, but the value of B tilde depends on the limit.
Hmm?
Is it the B tilde given by this log mu over M minus this?
Yeah, B tilde depends on the limit. I get a similar equation for the left movers.
So you take M goes to 0, N goes to 2 in such a way that B tilde remains finite?
Yes. And as I said, this is basically from the S matrix where I take the difference between rapidities to be finite as n goes to 2. So instead of having 8 gamma functions, I now only have 4, essentially.
So does the S matrix factorize into 3 parts? This would be a little more natural.
Well, the S matrix...
The S matrix
three factors?
Actually, the S matrix is a product of two factors, such that it's a product of two factors such that K of theta is a sum of two terms, one of which essentially becomes a delta function as n goes to 2, and one of which stays as kind of a Lorentzian type thing. So there are two different, one of the points is that there are two different limits of the S matrix. You can take the limit of the S matrix, keeping the difference between rapidities to be finite, which would be like taking two right movers, and n goes to 2. And then you get something like this. Or you can take the limit of the S matrix basically and imagine that you have two zero modes, which are going to be separated by the rapidities of the average.
Right movers at the speed of light, of course, don't scatter. So you're taking two right movers, which are very nearly the speed of light, and you're saying that their scattering is kind of independent of the scattering of two left movers, which are very similar.
Yeah.
Okay. And is this K thing some product of, sorry, is K a logarithmic derivative of a product of one of gamma functions?
Yeah. Then you have the zero mover equation, and I'll explain what chi is in a minute. I'm just going to write 1/2. And then you get two source terms, which depend on the number density of right movers and left movers. Okay, so we have zero modes, and this is basically the other limit of the S matrix. If you take the limit of the S matrix, but you allow the difference between rapidities of two particles to be large, for example, you can imagine I have a particle here and a particle here, then you get a different limit. And this is the equation that you get for the zero modes. Chi is the all-important factor that determines how you took the conformal limit. And it's finite, n minus 2 log v over m. Yes?
These zero movers are like additional states, which are a remnant of the fact that the theory is obtained from the O(n) theory with n. So in some sense, I mean, they wouldn't be there in an O2 theory if you just...
If I just started with the O2 theory, then all I would have would be right movers and left movers. But
so
this structure...
As n goes to 2, is not really an O2 theory, but it's an O2 theory plus these extra states.
Well, what we'll find is that these right movers and left movers are not really the same thing as a traditional right mover and a left mover. One of the reasons you can see this is because they scatter off each other. But what we'll find is that the number density by being very careful when you take the limit.
They're massless. They have to be one or the other.
Well, you know, if we started with a conformal theory, we wouldn't have these guys in the middle either. That doesn't make a lot of sense either. But so what we find is that the energy and momentum only depend on the right and left movers explicitly. And you can solve equations of this type because the integral is semi-infinite. You can solve them exactly. So that's very easy, and you can write down an answer. And the answer is deceptively simple. And you know something's wrong right away, because there's no dependence on the coupling G in these equations. Plus, you know, we know that there are these guys that got trapped in the middle, and they don't seem to be doing anything. And the problem is basically that what we've defined as a right mover and what we've defined as a left mover depends in detail on where we took the limit. We defined this location dependent on log of mu over m. So what we've actually done is we've hidden a dependence on the coupling in our definitions of JL and JR. And we don't really want to do this. We want to unwrap it. So the answer is to write the energy density as a function of the momentum density, which shouldn't depend on the coupling, and the total number of particles, which shouldn't depend on the limit I took.
By coupling, you mean, Rose, you're saying the radius of the circle, or implying the radius of the circle ultimately?
Not quite, and that's the point. The coupling 1 over g squared that I started with, which is the radius, in some transformation, the radius of the original Owen theory. This is exactly the point of what I'm doing, which is that chi hides the dependence of the coupling. So what we'll wind up with is states that depend on chi, and we're going to want to relate chi to g. And we can do that because O2 is a free theory for whom we know the answer.
Can I ask one more thing about the limit you're taking? So are you going to take BR to be finite?
BR?
Yes.
No, BR becomes infinite as m goes to zero.
Right. So the right mover is between BR and the log mu over n minus square root.
That's right. And when I take
that itself goes to infinity in the limit, right?
This?
Yes. The left edge of the right mover.
Both of these.
The thing is that you want to keep chi finite, so that means that the log mu over m should go like 1 over n minus 2.
Right.
So the left edge of the right mover is also going to be.
So basically what happens is I changed theta by an additive factor of log mu over m. So I subtracted log mu over m from here and log mu over m from here.
So this becomes
the finite b tilde. This is some finite number plus log mu over m.
So you take the limit so that the br minus log mu over m
is finite.
Okay.
And this end, when I subtract log mu over m, just becomes negative 1 over square root of n minus 2, which goes to negative infinity.
Thank you. Now it's clear. Right. Maybe you said it, but I
forgot.
Thank you.
Sorry. I still don't understand the answer to Rosie's question. Where's the radius? Is chi the? You said chi is not the radius. So
the radius. When I wrote down the original sigma model action, I pulled out the 1 over g squared coupling in front, which is essentially the radius.
Okay.
In the O2 theory, that's going to be the dependence on the radius. But the thing is that, in O2 is a conformal theory. So G is just a dimensionless parameter. But On is not conformal. So its S matrix cannot depend on a dimensionless parameter like that. So we have to reproduce the coupling in some other way. And chi is the obvious candidate because it's the only dimensionless parameter we have. So chi is going to be some function of g. And the point is that we have to figure out what that function is. Because if I was to do the whole thing again with the OSP theory, I would again wind up with a dependence on chi instead of the coupling that I want. And I'd have to unwrap it.
We're eventually going to come to the standard spectrum of the O2 model with momentum and winding and a radius?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, that is the goal. Mm-hmm. So I can rewrite this and now I have to cheat. 4 jr plus jl squared plus 1 over pi p squared over jr plus jl squared. This is just rewriting this cleverly. And what we want, of course, is to substitute j which is the number density of right movers plus left movers plus zero modes in here. And from looking at the zero mode equation, it becomes clear that the number density of zero modes is going to be some function of chi times the sum of right movers plus left mover number densities. So what we find is that j is going to be some function of chi, which is determined by this equation, times jr plus jl. And then when we plug this in, we get the normal expression, except in the place of coupling, I have h of chi. And now we see, by comparing this to the result for O2 straight from the action, realizing that it's a free theory, and then we can just write down the answer, what we find is that G squared is related to chi by this function, which is determined by this integral equation. Okay? So we worked very hard to get the answer for a free theory. But the point is that if you're going to study using integrability a theory that is conformal, you have to start with a non-conformal theory, because we can't really define an S matrix for a conformal theory. So you have to start with a non-conformal theory and write down a beta ansatz and then take a conformal limit. And the point is that through doing this, you're never going to get a direct dependence on the coupling. It's always going to be hidden in some other parameter that is dependent on how you took the conformal limit. So if you're ever going to use it, you're going to have to figure out some way of unwrapping the dependence of chi on g.
Can I understand this equation a little bit better? So the first term is probably, so these are representing some zero mode excitation.
Yeah.
Where are the oscillators of O2 model? So O2 model probably have zero mode piece and then harmonic oscillator.
That, do you remember the assumption we made where we took the simplest possible range of theta? We had ni plus 1 equal to ni. Any excitation off that is an excitation off the zero modes.
Oh, I see. So you change the ansatz at ni plus 1.
Right. This was going to be the lowest energy solution for a given amount of momentum and charge.
Oh, I see.
So it's the zero modes.
Okay. How about the quantization conditions? J and P over J be quantized? It's obvious.
Well,
that's what it is.
J is really.
J looks like a free parameter.
J is really the number of particles over L.
Yeah, exactly.
So if I then. Well, and so if I rewrote this.
I'm more worried about the P over J.
P over L. So E is equal to pi over 4 J squared over L H pi squared. This is just an integer, because this is the number of particles. I'm unwrapping the number densities into numbers. Plus 1 over pi L. This is the actual momentum instead of the momentum density. H of pi squared over j squared. And now this p is going to be some integer over 2 pi l, because the momentum has to be quantized. And this is just an integer, which is the number of particles. Does that make you happier?
No. I mean, there's an integer squared in the denominator. That doesn't look like what I know.
Well, if you
see n squared over r squared plus w squared times r squared, where n and w are integers for momentum and lining. You probably don't have lining, do you? Or do you know?
But yeah.
Second time is supposed to be lining.
Can I come back to this after the talk? Thank you. Okay. So the point is that, as I said, you've got some dependence. You've got some relationship between chi and g. You can solve this equation for large chi, and you can solve it for small chi. For large chi, what you find is that chi is approximately 2 pi over g squared, which corresponds exactly with the perturbative running of the coupling g squared in On. For small chi, what you find is that g squared is approximately pi over 2. And that's awkward, because what it tells us is that this integrability technique does not actually cover the full range of the coupling. It's exact in the coupling, except that the coupling can't be allowed to be more than pi over 2.
Is that the case? Yes.
Is that because of the T-duality? The radius, the space of radius is actually half an angle.
That's a very good idea. That seems very likely. Okay. So this is the large chi is the semi-classical regime, and small chi corresponds to perturbation around some fixed value of the coupling. And the whole point of everything that I've done so far is basically just to figure out what the relationship is between this parameter that arises when you try to use the beta ansatz in a conformal limit and the coupling that you actually want to express things in terms of. Okay. So now we want to move away from On to O2, and we want to think about OSP2N plus 2. What I'm going to do is I'm going to excite two different types of particles. I'm going to excite, basically, I'm going to give this is a somewhat of a simplification, because again, I'm not considering the annihilation of particle term in the S matrix. But this is equivalent to an SU2 sector of S5 in ADS5 cross S5.
Are these two O2 commuting with each other?
Yeah, they're just two O2 subgroups in OSP2N plus 2 2N. So I'm still only talking about bosons, and I'm making my life easier by not including the particle annihilation term. But this is equivalent to an SU2 sector. So It's a convenient, nice thing to do. And what we find, is that the beta ansatz gets changed. We have the same term we had before, where this runs over all of the particles, and then you multiply it by a factor which is the number of the second type of particle. And this And then you have another quantization for these parameters, lambda. I'm going to explain all of this in a second. Okay. Let's call these, let's do this to make our lives easier. So basically what we've done is we created a whole bunch of particles and we quantize the thetas, and now we're going to change some of them to the other kind of particle. And what's basically happening is I'm using a nested beta ansatz to do this. The particles that existed in the first half of the talk are now kind of sites on a spin chain. And the spin chain, each site can be either type 1 particle or type 2 particle. And the lambdas are the lambdas are pseudo rapidities along the spin chain. And what's important about this equation to realize is that to a large extent, it has to be, obviously these factors in minus 2 and whatnot are a function of the OSP system that I'm studying. But to a large extent, the structure that's present here is just determined by the symmetry of the SU2 sector and should almost exactly be the same thing we get for the ADS5 cross S5. Different numerical factors, but there's good reason to believe that it's very much the same. As I said, the thetas are, as before, the rapidities of the particles that exist. The lambdas are pseudo-rapidities of spin waves on the nested spin chain. So there are J2 of the second type of particle, and there's J total particles. And now I want to think about, suppose this was the answer for ADS5 cross S5. This S matrix is different. Some of these numerical factors are different.
Your vacuum was such that you had three kinds of particles.
Yep. Oh, you mean the right movers, left movers, yeah. And zero modes.
Can you turn each kind into another particle?
Yes, I think so.
And then something interesting happens depending on which type of particle you can.
Well, you're not really changing a right mover into, I mean.
But that's how the nested beta ansatz works, right? So you start from some vacuum, and then you start flipping.
This is still in the massive theory. So, you know, all of these thetas are fair game. And it's not really like I take a single particle of rapidity theta and I turn it into the other type of particle, right? It's the particles of each rapidity form a spin chain about which I.
Yeah, sure.
Okay. All right. So it's valuable to think about this as if it was the answer for ADS5 cross S5. And the obvious question is, okay, so on the string theory side, I've decided to try to build a string rotating around S5, and I seem to be describing it in terms of J parameters theta and J2 parameters lambda. But on the CFT side, we know that we're dealing with operators, and we think of these operators as an operator that's like z to the j, and then we add impurities. And the impurities each have some sort of spin wave rapidity. And basically, we have only J2 parameters because we give a rapidity to each impurity particle. Another way to think about this is that it seems as though I'm using J parameters theta to describe the operator z to the j, which we know only has one answer. So it should. So we have way more parameters that we need. And the answer we think that what we think is the answer is that if this really were a string theory, we would have Virasoro constraints. And we know that the Virasoro constraints are going to control what happens with the energy and the momentum because we want all of the Virasoro modes to vanish. So what we think is really going to happen is that these thetas wind up being determined by Virasoro constraints. And what you only really have is the nested beta ansatz, is these lambda parameters. Now, we're going to make a simple guess, which is that the thetas the answer for what the thetas are is the simplest possible thing. It's the, you know, single range of thetas with ni plus 1 equal to ni plus 1, so that you have the minimal energy kind of configuration here. And that condition, along with the determination of what lambdas are, completely determines your answer.
Once again, you have a kind of a very peculiar vacuum, right? And now you say that this vacuum somehow is an analog of Z to the J, an operator to the J.
Right.
So would you argue that indeed maybe you've understood something about this this vacuum that it could be qualitatively right in an AES 5 problems 5?
Well, what do you mean exactly by that?
It's a very kind of complicated vacuum, right?
Right.
The core in the middle and the left models.
But in a sense, it's the simplest possible answer, right? Because all I've done is pick, you know, whatever thetas are that correspond to each integer in a certain range is used to describe a theta. You say it's very.
What I don't understand. I mean, is this just? Do you think it's just a trick somehow to use this model, or do you rather think that there's actually something to be learned from this vacuum structure itself for AES 5 process 5?
Well. Okay, so the splitting into right movers and left movers and zero movers is basically a function of the fact that we don't know how to use the beta ansatz directly in a conformal theory. We want to write it down for a non-conformal theory and take a massless limit. It's possible that the kind of massless limit we took for ADS5 process 5 would look slightly different, and maybe it wouldn't have right movers and zero movers and all of this stuff. I don't know if that answers your question. Yes, it could. It could. The details of how that happened could depend on the way we took OSP the limit. Okay. But the kind of the point that I want to drive home is that it's these lambdas that correspond to kind of the rapidities on the spin chain that you would think of in the CFT. Those are the same kinds of degrees of freedom. And you can look at this and you can realize that there are two kinds of limits that you can take. When you take the thermodynamic limit, you want to scale J up. You want to take the number of particles to infinity, et cetera, et cetera. But you can either have a finite number of impurities as you take the length to infinity, or you can have a finite density of impurities. So we can either keep J2 finite, or we can keep J2 over L finite. And when we keep J2 finite, this is basically like a BMN state, where we have a state with really a lot of angular momentum about the five spheres, say, and then just a few charges of the other type. When you take the density to be finite, this is more like the spinning string solutions that people write down. I'm running out of time, so I kind of want to get to the punchline. Which is that if we take this equation and we take the semi-classical, we take the massless limit, and then first we take the L to infinity limit, then we take the massless limit, and then we take the semi-classical limit. we get a coupled pair of integral equations. The right movers and left movers don't change. You get a coupled pair of integral equations for the zero modes and some density of lambdas, sigma of lambda.
So semi-classical means g goes to zero?
Yeah, or chi goes to infinity in my language.
So in the case of O2, actually, this is a limit you couldn't take.
Chi goes to infinity, you can.
But what you find is you find a coupled pair of integral equations. And in fact, in the semi-classical limit, you can solve the equation for rho of theta in terms of sigma of lambda. And you can write down an equation that just depends on sigma of lambda. And reparametrizing things, what you get and this is very interesting. Because here what we've done is we've taken the SU2 sector of this, an SU2 sector of this OSP model, and we've taken the length of the space to be infinite, and we've taken the massless limit, and we've taken the semi-classical limit, and we wind up with eta of x, which is like sigma of lambda with some rescalings and redefinitions. And this equation is exactly what the equation that Nicholas never showed you in his talk last week is this equation is basically what comes out of, and again, what comes out of the work involving the semi-classical infinite number of charges in S5, where he showed you this picture where he uses that infinite number of non-local charges to build the sheets, the algebraic curve. And of course, since we're just in an SU2 sector, we only have two sheets. And the answer should be completely determined by, some branch cuts. And you can express this in terms of these pseudo-rapidities on the nested beta ansatz, but you can also get it from this algebraic curve. It's basically, if you define the function that has exactly this analytic structure with these square root branch cuts, then eta of x is like the discontinuity across these branch cuts. So it's the same equation that you get in both cases. And I'm going to say one last thing, which is that what we have, of course, is we started with an equation that was quantum mechanically exact. Now, it's for a different theory, and when you include quantum corrections, there's no reason to expect my answer to agree with ADS5 cross S5, except possibly in the generals, in the most general terms. But you can ask, what happens to these square root branch cuts when you go away from the semi-classical limit? And the answer appears to be, when we analyze this near the endpoints of these branches, is that it goes from being a square root branch cut to being a logarithmic branch cut. So that's a bit weird, but we go from having two sheets to having an infinite number. Basically, it comes from, you have some function equals source terms. And then as I take the semi-classical limit, that extends the range of this to infinity. And this becomes the principal part integral. And the principal part integral is basically corresponds to this square root thing. But you can also try to solve this equation at least near the endpoints without taking the semi-classical limit. And what you find is that the generalization of this function that has the square root branch cuts has logarithmic branch cuts in the same places.
That's weird.
It is definitely weird.
Are you sure about this? I mean, I would rather expect false.
Well, we expect that when we go away from the large L limit, when we take a finite volume, that this should turn into poles. That the poles condense in the infinite length limit. But away from the semi-classical limit, that doesn't appear to be what happens. So.
Did you prove that, or are you just thinking that?
Well, you can solve this equation near an endpoint. And then you can figure out the analogous function here, and you can show that it's logarithmic.
So it's like there are infinitely many other branch cuts coming from
infinity? It looks that way. Okay, so I want to leave you with four thoughts. The first is that to use integrability in a conformal sigma model, you have to start with a non-conformal sigma model. And as you take the massless limit, one of the features is that you don't get a direct dependence on the coupling. You always get a dependence on some parameter that depends on how you took the conformal limit, and it requires some work to figure out what the real dependence on the coupling is. The second is that when you use integrability in a field theory, you always wind up with kind of an extra layer of nesting from what the spin chain answer is. Because the vacuum, what you start with for an integrable field theory, has no particles in it. Whereas what you start with when you have a spin chain is a large amount of charge, all the particles pointing in the same direction, so all the spins pointing in the same direction. And then the third thing, which I didn't really discuss, so I'll leave out. Because I skipped it, but the fourth thing was this story, where we have interpreted this function eta of x, which they got as this discontinuity across branch cuts in the algebraic curve that is produced from the infinite number of non-local charges, can also be interpreted as some sort of density of pseudo rapidities on a nested spin chain.
Remind me what filter group you consider and how these subgroups
are embedded. So the original, so the story is about OSP,
yeah.
Which
OSP,
Oh, capital N is 2 now.
So you take capital N and you send capital N to 2.
Right. And that gives you a conformal sigma model.
Is it well defined? Is it super good? Or is it non-equilibrium?
You mean is when if you mean if I stopped at n equals 1/2, what does that mean?
Yeah.
I'm really not sure.
Because people usually use supergroups to avoid taking these any limits, continuous number of fermions, bosons.
I'm sorry, I don't have a short answer for you, but the O2s that I was looking at are inside here. They're bosonic O2s.
Kind of generalization.
Yeah, it's a way of getting more. It's a way of getting an SU2 sector in a conformal theory.
So then you embed SU2 in this 2n+2 part.
Yes, it's all I talked about today were bosonic excitations. I didn't throw any fermions at you.
What is the motivation to assume that the physical state condition fixes theta?
What was the motivation?
Right. What was the motivation for that assumption?
Well, the first motivation was that choosing the simplest range of theta is the easiest thing to do. And then when we start actually doing that, we saw that the states that we were getting and the equations that we were getting were the same as the equations that you would take for ADS5 plus S5 in the semiclassical limit with the Virasoro constraints imposed. So then we started thinking that there was more to that. You can also, for some simple cases, you can start with the simple assumption about the thetas, and you can think about excitations off this, and you can see that if this was a string theory and you had all this gauge symmetry around, you could get rid of it, that it corresponded to some sort of a gauge transformation. For some of the simplest ones, you can see that these excitations are really just a gauge transformation.
Am I supposed to be the coordinator of this lecture?
You guys are supposed to tell
you guys
what.
Or throw rotten food.
Okay, let's clap.